Okay.
Well, the story finally got itself worked out. Strain A, in which we'd made some double nutritional mutants, was carrying a bacteriophage, which we call PLT22, phage of Lillingen type 22. Lillingen was the guy who gave us the strains. He had a collection of Salmonella strains. The other strain might be LT7 and was susceptible to the phage PLT22. So the condition starts from the LT22 strain, grows on the LT7 strain. Now you have a crop of phage. That phage can be reabsorbed back onto cells, might be a fresh batch or a different genotype, of LT22 strain origin. When it does so, it also carries genetic markers from the LT7. And those were the recombinants that we'd seen. But the mechanism is quite different. It's not cell-to-cell contact. It's phage particles carrying tiny bits of genetic information from the host in which they've just been grown to the new host that they're going to enter into. So it was a new phenomenon. I wanted to give it a distinctive name, and I called it viral transduction. This has had very important repercussions and is now the basis of gene therapy when people are using retroviruses to import genes into human cells. Essentially the same phenomenon. It also opened up doing genetics in Salmonella, quite apart from the rather far-reaching implications of the view that a virus could have genetic functions. You couldn't think of it only as a pathological entity. As soon as was possible to do this, I differentiated my own interest in the Salmonella story to be the pursuit of the serological types. I went to visit P.R. Edwards, who was the honcho of Salmonella serology in this country at that time, down in Chambly, in the unit that's now the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. It was in a suburb at that time. Spent 3 weeks there picking up his lore, getting him interested in it, reagents, and we had a very effective and extensive collaboration after that, and very promptly corroborated that indeed you could generate a wide variety of new serotypes by transductional recombination. And no one doubts that that's the natural historical source of this kind of diversification. Still a lot of unanswered questions about Salmonella virulence and serology, but those fundamentals have stood up very well. In retrospect, Norton thought I was very dense about not seeing that phage was the mediating factor. And I don't recall the detailed incident, but in his write-up he says it was Harriet Fussy who said that's what it must be when he described this general pattern of events. We knew that it was at one stage, we knew it was associated with phage. We could get the filterable activity defined as that which transforms cells of the nutritionally negative phenotype to the nutritionally positive one. That was our bioassay. By growing, they were present in phage lysates. But my not yet being prepared to insist on the view that the phage itself was a genetic vehicle, I thought that this was a way of liberating, solubilizing genetic constituents in the cell, which is certainly true, without necessarily having to be packaged within the phage particles. And when the issue was put that way, we then continued to fractionate the activity and show that it's sedimented with the phage. And that was really the only evidence that it really isn't the phage itself and not some ancillary material connected with it. With specialized transduction, which came up a little bit later on, another one of my graduate students, was working on the genetics of the galactose genes in E. coli. This is an extension of the work on the lactase loci. These are enzymes in galactose metabolism. And he ran into somewhat similar kinds of observations, and quickly the basis of what had been gone on before was able to come to the conclusion that the phage lambda, which is present in E. coli K12, could pick up the GAL gene. And unlike salmonella, not a lot of the others. It was quite specialized. So it would be just that one factor, and that would remain associated with the lambda during further propagation. And so there, the association of the genetic activity with the phage was clearer right from the start. Turns out it's a defective phage in that case. That is, you can generate lambda particles containing the GAL gene, but those particular particles then do not convey a full-blown lambda infection. You have to replace a vital gene of the lambda with a gene from the host, and that makes the phage defective as far as further infection is concerned. So it got to be a little bit more complicated. But here were now two systems of viral transduction going on side by side, and enough difference between them to suggest to us that we're into a whole new family of phenomena, and we ourselves didn't push for many more, but others have, and it's now known that there's a wide variety of interactions of which these are special examples. That in turn supported the more general philosophical concept of the plasmid, just a way of looking at genetic particles that says, let's not waste a lot of time deciding whether something is a virus or a gene. That has to do with just what impact they have on the further development of the cell. In either case, this is genetic information. Can be used either ways, and that's been a very important unifying concept. It's removed all the quarrels about whether something was a genetic phenomenon or an infectious phenomenon. It says it can be both. A little bit of a wave-particle dualism that one can resolve in that way. That's been quite important in straightening out a major source of confusion in biological development. Sonneborn got to be impaled on that. He was very excited about cytoplasmic heredity in paramecium, as he should have been. Then came under attack when people said, oh, these kappa particles are merely symbiotic bacteria, they are not genes. And I tried to say there's not a contradiction between those two statements. Sonneborn himself never completely bought it, but I think that's the way most people would view it today. Jan Sapp was here last year. He's written his third book. This one is on the history of symbiosis, and he's done a very good job of integrating that part of the story in his writing. And he knows much more about the Sonneborn archives and correspondence and so on than I do. It's really a pleasure to hear from him about that. That book will be coming out pretty soon. So the plasmid concept was fired up by what I've just told you, the ambiguities of what is lambda. Here we have a bacterium, which then every now and then gives rise to a bacteriophage. We were able to even localize the map location of the lambda-generating factor on the chromosome, and it happens to be right next to the gal factor, which is not a coincidence. And so you could again have this dualism of something that was in the chromosome coming out and being a virus. And then there was the other phenomenon, again just fell into our laps. Both in the case of the original discovery of lambda as a phage in resident E. coli, and the discovery of the F factor, which is the factor necessary for fertility in E. coli crosses, which turns out to be another cytoplasmic particle. In fact, it doesn't make a phage, but it's a little bit like lambda. It can live either in the cytoplasm as a plasmid, or it can become integrated into the chromosome, and then it becomes Lucas HFR when it's so integrated. But in this case, it cannot package an externally viable particle, which is what a virus can do. So it has an incomplete cycle as a virus, and it can only get from cell to cell by cell conjugation. It doesn't, in normal life history, the bacteria doesn't have a free-living state of a packaged virus particle. It wouldn't last very long as free DNA if it ever got out of the cell. Anyhow, those observations led to the formulation of the plasmid concept. So they were a reintegration of this variety of experimental observations. They were not part of my original research program. But in those days, you could walk down a path and stumble on a stone, pick it up, and there'd be a golden newt under it almost every time you went anywhere. I was about to say that the initial observations, both of lambda and of F, came from Esther's very astute abilities to observe what was happening in the course of other very routine work. And there were two very similar occasions when she would show me these plates, and there was this curious anomaly, and she had just noticed that things weren't going the way they were supposed to in certain combinations of crosses, and she does certainly deserve very great credit for her observational skills. It took more than that to go through the experimental analysis, and I won't say any more than that.
Up to the time you went to, I'm sort of looking at the time frame from starting at Wisconsin to when you went to Berkeley, was it 50, summer of 50, so I'm looking at that time frame right now. How many graduates, how easily was it for you to get graduate students first?
Well, I got them, it wasn't easy, but...
How did you attract Norton Zinn?
I'm trying to remember. I suspect mostly writing letters and the informal network. We didn't do much advertising in those days, but I don't recall if we did. I'll have to look up my Morse correspondence. In his case, Norton's case, he was recommended to me by Francis Ryan.
Network.
So it was word of mouth. Ethlyn Lively, Miriam Freed, but they were word of mouth associations.
You said Norton didn't start until the second year, actually the second year. So
right.
Were you doing much of your own work that first year, or were you just getting things set up?
Well, setting it up. We did go along, and here's where Esther worked like a Trojan too in the laboratory. I had a research assistant. So it would have been probably three people, maybe a part-time dishwasher. Was allowed that first year and didn't get to be ever much larger than that. It might have been two or three others.
You received offers of other positions at least twice in this time frame, once in Chicago in 49 and I think once at Oak Ridge in 50.
Well, a little more than that.
Just from your notes up to there.
50, well, those are, yes, that's right. I didn't take Oak Ridge too seriously. Preoccupation with academic matters, but came a little too soon. We had just moved, and the idea of living in Chicago and on the South Side was not very appealing. I think that was what it hinged on. And we did have contacts there who visited fairly frequently, though we're not totally pressed.
Your notes talk about the first press notice in May of 49 in the Madison newspaper about bacteria having sex life.
Mm-hmm. I'd run into this somewhere, and I just thought I'd catalog it that way,
So at the time, you weren't, I mean, this is something you've done retrospectively in terms, rather than at the time. I was after how you reacted to seeing something like that in print.
I wasn't too interested. In fact, a few years later, when would it have been? Maybe around 55. I had a bid there was a well-known Wisconsin painter, Aaron, I'll get his name out of my file. I haven't followed Wisconsin art that closely. And he told me Time Magazine had commissioned him to do a portrait, and I was going to be a cover personality on Time, and I said I didn't want to do it.
Why?
I didn't think that public hoopla would be of any particular use to me or to the public, and I didn't think the press would handle things. Borod was his name, Aaron Borod, in a particularly accurate or graceful way, and I didn't like being a subject in somebody else's hands. I guess I still have some feeling about that. I refuse to be sculpted and refuse to be subject of some great photographic artist. I think for them to pursue their profession is fine, but I have something else to do than to be their clay.
Well, let's jump ahead a little bit then, since you're talking about that. You couldn't avoid the media when you won the Nobel.
That's
How
right.
How did you handle that?
Well, best I could. I don't think I went out of my way to attract attention, but that was not within my hands. So I began to think a little bit more carefully about what use to make of it. If it was both unavoidable and easily attainable, and there's a fine line between the two, and maybe I developed a little further confidence that I could control what would be a very difficult interaction, that I better get into it. So I began to start thinking of being a voice for something, and it's an interesting question, what? It eventually materialized. Not that many years later, I decided I wasn't going to entrust my interactions with the press to the press. I was going to write on my own. So starting in 1966, I had my own column in the Washington Post. That's flipping from one extreme to the other, but avoiding what was my real fear and bane. And that was being misrepresented, over-sensationalized, dealt with in a shallow or inaccurate manner by the press. I guess I still feel that way. I much prefer to speak for myself and have somebody else do it for me.
Well, certainly that headline from the Madison paper is typical of the kind of what the press will do with something like
that. Yeah, well, that was... I don't remember being offended by it, but it was what I knew would be the fate of any press mangling. No, I didn't know any Walter Sullivans or Larry Altmans in those days. If I had, I think I might have been more than happy to confide in how they would deal with it. But I was really quite inexperienced on this matter. I started out with certain prejudices and then had the feeling that I wasn't sure that that this couldn't get out of control and was better shy away from it. And I was not interested in public publicity. I didn't see what it had to do with my scientific work, and I was never averse to trying to teach others, but it didn't seem to me that this press coverage was going to do that either, so...
Well, maybe I could pursue that a little more, because what is the responsibility of the scientist towards educating the public? And is there a responsibility for people to...
Well, I don't lay a trip on individuals. I think it's very important that the public be educated. And I think that scientists who have the knack don't need to be told that... I will say it's a responsibility in the sense we shouldn't chide or downgrade people who exercise it. And I think Carl Sagan has gotten some inappropriate knocks for that reason. So I winced a little bit when I've seen some of what he's had to do or wanted to do. But after that instant reaction, I go back and that would congratulate him. And, I'm glad he's a headline hound because it helps motivate him to do something that somebody really ought to do. But it doesn't mean I want to operate in that mode. So I speak to a little different level of audience than he does, and I think they're both an important role. I don't think I wrote anything for public interest or consumption before the early 60s. And the first place I can recall that is the SIBA Symposium on the Future of Man that was held in London in 1962.
How did this column in the Post get started?
Nigel Calder, sitting on the airplane from Nice to London, I guess, and then I was going to go on back to New York, we both attended a meeting of COSPAR. He was reporting on it for the either the New Statesman or the New Scientist, if the latter was in being by that time, and he asked me if I would be willing to write a regular column for it. And I said I didn't think so, but I would give it some thought, and I found that I was giving it some thought. And then, as is my wont in those cases, I say, well, don't just jump. Try to understand the context of this interest, and if you're going to do it, ask yourself, is this the optimum of that genre that you'd want to do? And I thought, well, for the effort given, there'd be a rather modest audience in the New Scientist, especially at that time, that maybe I could, if it were the New York Times, I might think that the effort would be worthwhile. I tried that, didn't get very far, but I did have some contacts with the Graham family, and also with Howard Simons, who was the science editor of the Washington Post, and that materialized, so that's how it happened.
How long did that run?
5 years, and then some, kind of petered out during the sixth year. I stopped doing it primarily because I could not turn myself into a reporter in the sense of writing a column or doing a piece and then putting it out of mind and doing something else. I ended up continuing to research the columns that I did, often by a factor of 10 or 100 times more. Once the subject had opened up, I couldn't let it go. I decided, that's okay, you may pull all that material together in various ways, but you can't keep multiplying it. So that was too much of a scholar to jump around from one topic to another and then give it the depth that I felt it needed.